The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to us on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Now, after taking the world by storm for his spring 2014 article, The Case for Reparations, in the Atlantic Monthly, Ta-Nehisi Coates is back again with another cover story for The Atlantic, which is now their longest story published ever in over a decade. The piece is titled The Black Family in the Age of Mass Incarceration. And, of course, he's also the author of Between the World and Me and The Beautiful Struggle. And, Ta-Nehisi, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. I wish it weren't the longest story published in the last 10 years.
Why?
I'm not happy about that.
But I said that like I was kind of cool. It's like an honor. There's a lot to say.
I know. And people, I know why people say that. But you know, brevity is the friend. If it wasn't so, you know, it's such a complicated issue. You know, I really wanted to take it apart. But boy, it could have been shorter. My book is short. I do have that. My book is short.
Your book is short. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Right.
So I won't say that again. I didn't mean it as a compliment, though.
No, I took it as a compliment. I'm just messing with you.
Y'all can join us at 410-319-8888. Right to us here at talkingsteinershow.org and tweet us at Mark Steiner. So I'm really fascinated by this, the way you come up with things. And you started off with and built it around, in some ways, the Daniel Moynihan piece from the 60s, which caused such a furor in America on many sides, The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. And your analysis of it, I thought, was kind of refreshing in the light of 2015. So talk about why you started there.
Well, I mean, the Atlantic styles itself as a place that, you know, tries to, especially under you know, my editor, Scott Stockland, and now, you know, President James Bennett, you know, really trying to put his footprint on, you know, certain things. And that was really, you know, I had so many folks come up to me and say, well, how'd you get him to let you publish a reparations article? You know, but it is a place that's interested in, you know, sort of, you know, solutions and, you know, ideas that, you know, maybe are not, you know, on the table right now. And mass incarceration is something that's been talked about quite a bit. How somebody was going to write about this and, you know, do it in some sort of way, I really had no idea. But I was, you know, always interested in the fact that incarceration had on African-American families, you know, and I had been thinking about that. At the time, we were on the cusp of this 50th anniversary of the Moynihan Report. There were a lot of people out there, you know, talking about it. And I thought, you know, giving a perspective that did not necessarily reflect the breadth of, you know, the issue, both good and bad. And I thought that, you know, might be a way of connecting to Moynihan was so concerned about African-American families. And if, you know, I think if he were alive today, you know, he was trying to think about the fate of African American families, he would obviously be talking about mass incarceration as everyone else is.
Well, he slid into that. And I mean, because, well, let me talk about that in a moment, about how this whole idea of worrying about where things are slides right into mass incarceration, which I think is part of the heart of the article. But some of these quotes, when you look at Daniel Moynihan's quotes, like the Negro family, three centuries of sometimes unimaginable mistreatment, the racist virus in American bloodstream, that the Negro American has survived it all is extraordinary. A lesser people might have died out, as indeed others have. And then you have President Johnson, who quoted at a speech at Howard University, saying, For this, most of all, white America must accept responsibility. Talking about racism, flows from centuries of oppression and persecution of the Negro man. It flows from long years of degradation and discrimination, which have attacked his dignity, assaulted his ability to produce for his family. I mean, they were making, President Johnson's making the argument for reparations.
I mean, he really is. I mean,
right?
I might have missed that part in what you just said, but he literally says in the speech something about how you don't, you know, just bring a man up to the finish line, say, you know, up to the starting line, say everything's okay.
Right.
You know, so, no, he is, and it is, you know, we can get to, you know, like, the problems with the Moynihan Report in a second, but, I just want to say, like, Moynihan was somebody that, you know, endorses one of the solutions, a guaranteed income for all Americans, and maybe Bernie Sanders is calling for that, but
right.
That is basically outside of any sort of mainstream conversation today, and as I, you know, get to towards the end of the piece, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it was very much endorsing the idea of reparations, which he termed as unequal treatment in the present for unequal treatment in the past. I don't know what that is besides reparations. Now, he changed and, you know, moved into different places, but, You know, I think that, you know, whatever the problems are with the Moynihan Report, and there are many, you know, the willingness to say, listen, this is what's ultimately responsible. This is where the history is. That sort of memory, you know, was there. And that's just not something that you find today in terms of our political discussions. We want to forget.
We do, and I really struck me, because I'd forgotten all about that speech and that piece of it. But talk about the contradictions for just a minute before we talk about the history and where we are now, but about Moynihan's report.
Yeah, well, so within that, you know, it's a good part of the history being present, but there was a perspective, you know, on African-American families, and specifically on, you know, African-American women, you know, above all, that I think was deeply, deeply problematic.
Yes.
Moynihan, you know, and not, you know, wholly wrong, you know, identified this issue of unemployment among African-American men as being a major problem. But, you know, following, you know, a long line of sociology and psychology, I think he, you know, sort of fell into the trap of blaming black women as for why that was the case to begin with. Not so much in the report, but in his memos, you can read him actively, you know, arguing for black women to be pushed out of jobs for in favor of black men. And I think, you know, when you know, that sort of perspective on black people and on black women and on black families, you know, is very, very familiar, you know, in the history of white reformers in this country. It's an abstraction that, you know, really, you know, wouldn't play if you had to go into anybody's household, you know, into a black household and sort of, you know, make that case. People would look at you like you were crazy, and they would look at you like that because, you know, they're human beings, you know, human families. And I think that sort of abstraction actually is not wholly disconnected from a world in which we have mass incarceration like we do today. The first step, you know, into getting into a system where, you know, we have, you know, something on the order of 400,000 African American males in jail, a 70% chance of black males going to prison if they drop out of college, 1 in 3 black males of this generation going to, you know, prison. Sorry, that's high school, not college. The first step in getting to that is looking at African American communities as though they're somehow fundamentally different. And unfortunately, I think the report is part of that.
And there's one piece here, because you do this in all of your books, and I think it's deeply important, just to jump to this for a moment, two things I want to raise. First of all, you always come up with new ways of describing something, like the gray wastes.
Yeah, it's important, I think.
I think go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, as a writer, my job, and I wrote about this a little bit today, is to try to make things as clear as I possibly can. And part of that is, you know, in not just, you know, in, you know, going with the stats and going into details, but how we actually talk about things, the actual language, you know, that I use. And I just thought that was a very, very evocative phrase, you know, in terms of, you know, when you picture, you know, a sprawling sort of system of jails and prisons, and even beyond that, you know, the sort of, when you, if you want to include parole and probation, African Americans under, you know, the surveillance of the state, it is like another world that we inhabit. You know, there are very, very few people or other groups of people inhabit in the same sort of way. And if you, you know, add on to that, the fact that, you know, as I've said before, you know, unfreedom for African Americans in this country is the historical norm. That, you know, we're perpetrating these kinds of incarceration levels on a population that, as, you know, Professor Bruce Weston, you know, says, you know, for us at The Atlantic, who on a population that already had a tenuous relationship with freedom to begin with. You know, you begin to see that black people themselves, you know, sort of live in another world that very, very few other groups of people inhabit.
You know, I think that when you look at the history and the present, I think it's kind of really important to dwell for a second on some of the words that you use yourself when you talk about the inhabitants of the gray waste, that these inhabitants, black people, are the preeminent outlaws of the American imagination, and then go on to talk about the link between the 19th century view of the bestiality of black men, black men are beasts, to the super predator youth.
Right.
And that link is very important in terms of the consciousness in America that even allows what is happening to take place, right?
That's right. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. I mean, put bluntly, my case is that mass incarceration could not have happened without a certain view of black people. And that view, unfortunately, stretches back and even beyond, you know, to our birth as a country. You know, as I say in the piece, you know, the first fugitive slave laws are in the Constitution. You know, and so what that effectively means is the notion that black people pursuing the kind of freedom and the kind of liberty and the kind of pursuit of happiness that, you know, this country was founded on. When we founded this country, that was criminal. Frederick Douglass is referred to as a criminal. As he talks
right.
about, you know, I appear here, you know, tonight before you as a thief. I've stolen my head. I've stolen my body. The Underground Railroad, the price put on Harriet Tubman, said, you know, these folks are considered criminals. Martin Luther King is regarded, you know, as I say in the piece, as a criminal by J. Edgar Hoover, criminalized three generations of African-American leadership.
For calls to the United States and Canada, please dial 1
no.
before the area code. Please enter your destination number now.
Ta-Nehisi, you still with us? Shoot. So we'll get right back to Ta-Nehisi.
The number you dialed was not recognized.
So Ta-Nehisi Coates is talking to us from Paris, which is why we got some kind of weird disconnect long distance. But we will try to get that back as quickly as humanly possible to get him back on the phone. And you can also join us here, 410-319-8888, during the course of the, as we wait for Ta-Nehisi to be reconnected. Is he back now? Just about. 410-319-8888. We will have a link, by the way, to Ta-Nehisi's article on our website, because it's one that I think everybody needs to kind of read and take hold of. What he's making us think about in America, the fact that he's able to talk to all of America through the Atlantic is, I think, one of the most important, powerful pieces that exist. The article is called The Black Family in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Have him back? You still trying to get him back? So as soon as he gets back, we will get him on, but we do want you to join us at 410-319-8888. One of the things he posits in this piece, I think that he makes these connections about how the liberal governments of our country, Democrats like Joe Biden, like Bill Clinton, and Martin O'Malley, have bought into this and created this world that pushed and wanted. There he is. He's back. Are you back? Ta-Nehisi, great. I'm sorry, man.
I am. I'm so sorry about that.
That happens. Go ahead.
I think I went on for like 5 minutes or something.
Well, you can pick up.
Sorry.
We were just saying how the connection between the bestiality and of the 19th century and where we are in the 20th century are deeply connected here, and that's what you were saying in this article.
Yeah, no, it's just that. It's just that. I mean, I would say that, you know, if you have a kind of skepticism of African-American communities that, you know, has been displayed in public policy and by, you know, I think is, you know, for most of our history, it's very easy to see how we ended up in this situation. I don't think you can have mass incarceration without white supremacy.
So, but the whole dynamic of that, I mean, in terms of how you're writing this article, is also has to do with how we, as I was reading the quotes from Joe Biden, about how the liberals are now want to have the Democratic Party liberals are now for 60 new death penalties. The liberal wing is now for 70 enhanced penalties. The liberal wing of the Democratic Party is for 100,000 cops. The liberal wing is for 125,000 new state prison cells. That the body politic feels as if it has to play to that mindset to win. And that mindset means to win, you have to criminalize what black means.
I'm not even gonna say I forgot about that. I didn't know that. I didn't know about the Biden stuff until, like, I didn't go in knowing that. And that is just shocking. I mean, he has a quote where he literally says, you know, quite frankly, my job is to lie. I want to lock Willie Horton up, you know, without engaging in what any of that meant. Worse than those Joe Biden quotes, you had, you know, Democratic senators and Democratic representatives who said, you know, right out, this bill's a bad idea. They said it during, you know, in 86 when you had the crack cocaine disparity, when that was passed. They said, these bills are bad ideas. This sort of crime policy is just playing to a certain portion of the electorate. And many of them voted for it anyway.
Right.
I mean, it's just...
right.
It's deeply sad. You see, that, you know, I have no joy. You know, I'm not, you know, trying to, you know, beat people over the head with anything. But I think, like, it's really, really instructive to us to understand what exactly happened. That's very, very sad.
So as you did in the article, link that idea to mass incarceration, the arrest rate and mass incarceration rates, to the actual crime rate. I thought that was really fascinating how you pulled that stuff out from different studies.
Well, it's hard. It's very, very hard to link. I mean, you know, the study I have and I, you know, the big one that I relied on was done by the National Research Council. It's entitled The Growth of Incarceration. I encourage people to go online and get that. You can read it, you know, PDF. It looks at all. It's an encyclopedic attempt to understand what exactly happened to us over the past 40 years. And it was authored by some of our leading experts on criminal justice in this country. And what they found was basically the most you can say is maybe the incarceration mass incarceration cut crime by perhaps 2 to 5%. That's the best we got, you know, for all the billions of dollars that we invested in it. You know, this becomes even more obvious. You don't even need a study to see some of the problems with those theories. We have a chart in the piece where we show how, incarceration begins to change, you know, roughly in the 1970s. But actually, crime began to go up in the 1960s, and it was going up as incarceration rates went down. And then you start getting into the mid-70s and into the 80s, and you see that crime is rising at the same time as incarceration. And then you get into the early and mid-90s, into the 2000s, and you see the incarceration rate continuing to rise even as crime goes down. What that shows you is that you don't even really have a correlation or a strong correlation between the two. It's not as though, you know, crime goes down as incarceration, you know, goes up. You just can't establish that. Beyond that, we have a geographic problem. The crime rise was an international phenomenon. The sort of crime that we saw rising in the 60s into the 70s into the 80s and declining in the 90s was an international phenomenon. America is the only country in the world that responded by incarcerating upwards of 700 per 100,000. Obviously, we're the only people that saw the need to erect a gray waste, you know? And so what you're talking about is clearly something peculiar about America. It's not enough to simply say, well, crime went up and that's what happened and this is what we decided to do. Well, yeah, I'm sure that furnished the reason. But why did we make this choice? There were a suite of other choices that we could have made. Why did we make this particular choice around mass incarceration?
Well, you know, when this began, and Moynihan in many ways was vilified, as you wrote about, by the left and by people in the revolutionary and nationalist movement in this country, both. For what he wrote, I think, and it's some of the things where people actually probably didn't read the story so much as read the headlines that America wrote about what he said. Yeah. But then he morphed as well.
It's almost as if, I mean, I think like one of the things that happened was that, first of all, you know, in terms of the release of the report, it was poorly handled, you know, or across the board. So to the extent that you had folks, as you said, reading headlines and making arguments about, you know, what it seemed the Moynihan report, you know, said as opposed to what it actually said. And I got to be honest with you, that continues even to today. I just, I hate to, you know, quibble with, you know, my friends on the left, but when folks say Moynihan was blaming the victim, I just think that's dead wrong. If you look at the report, you know, I think he's very, very clear about where, you know, the blame should be apportioned. And then if you listen to, you know, if you read Johnson's speech, which is based on a report, there's no question. Now, you know, come out and outright say, you know, white society has to take the blame for this. You know, at the same time, that same Moynihan went into the Nixon White House and wrote some of the most destructive memos that you ever want to see, you know, arguing that, you know, in fact, that, you know, the black middle class was using the black poor to blackmail the white population in this country into giving them certain things. The same sort of rhetoric that you would have heard 100 years before, arguing that, you know, that crime was actually a function, you know, of black people hating white people. You know, that is part of Moynihan's legacy, unfortunately, too. Into the 80s, arguing that drug use, that when we talk about drug use, we're actually talking about inner-city black males, even though, you know, if you look at, you know, actually who uses drugs, you see no real discrepancy between black and white America. So, yeah, he became part of the problem. You know, it's almost as if he came to embody the worst sort of, you know, caricatures of his report. He became that person. That's sad, too. But, you know, I think even as I say that, the thing that you also have to remember about Moynihan is at the very end when welfare reform comes up in 1996, he actually voted against it. He thought it was too punitive. He thought it was just going to throw, you know, poor people out onto the streets. He had, you know, ended up a bitter foe, you know, of Bill Clinton's welfare reform. So, you know, I think, you know, like one of my tasks was to try to get my arms around, you know, Moynihan and get his whole legacy in perspective.
Well, clearly, you help us see him as a tortured human being. In many ways, right?
I mean, it's a part of somebody. somebody whose father left him.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, right.
It's very, very interesting. You know, there's a, I would hasten to even add, and this was pointed out to me after, you know, the report came up, this, you know, rhetoric about fathers, and fathers are important. You know, I wrote a whole memoir talking about how my father was important.
Yeah.
Fathers are important, but, you know, this notion that fathers are the silver bullet to policy in America that stretches through Moynihan, that goes into Bill Clinton, that goes, you know, into Obama. You are in every case talking about people with problematic relationships with their own father, and that is, you know, that can't be, you know, subtracted, I don't think, from, you know, the policy prescription.
Right. We take chunks of things and create policies. So we create policies now that are talking about the problem with black men and black fathers, and that becomes the policy that we want to look at without looking at the whole. Moynihan did the same thing.
Right. That's it. It should be a part of something much, much bigger, you know. But I think fathers are something that's easy to talk about right now. You know, I don't want to, you know, malign, you know, policy folks who are doing their best to get something done. And, you know, they're taking, you know, what they can take. You know, they're working within, you know, what's possible. You know, but as a writer, my job is to remind folks that that won't be sufficient for the society itself.
One of the things that you do in this article, which I think is important, as we, you know, I think that broadening the idea of the debate around what reparations means and how we get into how we create, how America was created and who we are as a people in the 21st century is part of what you're doing in the pieces that you read, at least my interpretation of that. And part of how you're doing that as well is the way you take out people in this particular article from Detroit and Baltimore, stories of families, of human beings, how this affected them, who they are, how they feel, what happens to their families. I mean, that's how many, what happens to families that are part of this incarceration empire in America, what happens to the children and the people left behind. I mean, that's an important piece of this.
No, it's extremely important because, you know, I can't make the same mistake and get caught in my own theory and abstractions, too. You know, if you can't go and talk directly to the folks who you claim that, you know, this is what's happening to, then, you know, your whole theory is incomplete. And so it's very, very important in all of my pieces, you know, even in, you know, especially I would argue in the reparations piece, you know, and in this one and in the book, quite frankly, too, that, you know, as I lay out, you know, all of my theory of what I think is actually happening, to go in and talk to real people and see how well that matches up. Frankly, what, you know, and this doesn't make it into the final draft, but often you find out that the theories you had going in are not ultimately, you know, what is actually going on. You know, real people involve a check on, you know, just over intellectualizing and just, you know, being an armchair, you know, philosopher.
So, right. No, and you're not that. But I mean, so I'm curious where this article took you, where we're taking us. I mean, when we see that because of, I think, fiscal reasons, people on the right and some liberals are saying we have to back off of incarceration, though we haven't seen any strong policy directed towards that. But I mean, when you look at what Moynihan was talking about in the beginning, what the parts he did not put in the report that was supposed to be a private report, the parts talking about almost like a Marshall Plan for people in Black America.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so this is part of, I think, broadening a discussion and not just making it, not simplistic is the wrong word, not making it simply about changing mass incarceration. That mass incarceration is a huge linchpin in a bigger issue.
Right?
It is.
Yes, no, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And I'm deeply skeptical of the notion that you can somehow get us to an equitable system of criminal justice in this country without some sort of engagement of the bigger issues of white supremacy. You can't really talk about why African Americans are incarcerated at the rate that they're incarcerated if you're not going to have a conversation about segregation in this country and the policies that make segregation possible. You can't really, you know, come to understand why, you know, African Americans are, you know, churned through the criminal justice system. I'm not talking about the large population in terms of mass incarceration, but let's just talk about arrests, likelihood of arrest.
Right.
You can't understand that and drug policy without understanding segregation and where black people live. It's just there's just no way to do both. That's just one instance. You know, but this idea that we can just, you know, look at one thread, you know, to get us straight, I think is off.
Well, I know we have a brief time together today, but I do appreciate you coming on, joining us from this lovely afternoon in Paris. That's why nobody likes you being in Paris.
I wanted to tell you I was hating it.
Yeah, right, sure, right, you're hating it, right. Ta-Nehisi's piece, we'll link to it on our website, SinusShow.org, The Black Family and the Age of Mass Incarceration, national correspondent of The Atlantic, author of the books we've talked about before, Between the World and Me and The Beautiful Struggle. Ta-Nehisi, thanks so much, man. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much, Mark. Have a great day.
You too, man. Take care. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back and continue talking about what Ta-Nehisi has written with Adar Ayira and Lennon McAllister. So please stay with us. Do not go away. And we'll continue our conversation. Those calling in, we'll get your calls during this conversation. Stay with us.